Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Welcome to the Daily Jungle. What an insane weekend of sports that was. Ohio State ran down Penn State in the shoe. Florida ran Jim McElwain, while Butch Jones somehow still has his gig. And Game 5 was legendary in the World Series. Baseball is flying right out of the juice box as the Astros win 13-12 in extras. And our three guests all brought it. We had Sports Illustrated's Craig Bishop. And our three guests all brought it. Sports Illustrated's Greg Bishop, Memphis Tigers quarterback Riley Ferguson, and Steelers defensive lineman Cam Hayward. Alvy, it's all on you, so do what you do. Got to start with some baseball. Hey, remember when Game 2 of the 2017 World Series was the craziest game that you could ever see? Yeah, well, it didn't hold the title for even a week before Game 5 ripped it away last night. 13-12. Astros, more than 5 hours and 15 minutes, 10 innings, 28 hits, 25 runs, 7 home runs. How crazy was it? Clayton Kershaw and Dallas Keuchel, with 4 Cy Young Awards between them, started a game that had 25 runs in it. It was a baseball game with a football score and a guy named Derek Fisher scoring the winning run. And that really didn't feel like Dodgers v. Astros in the World Series. That felt more like the homeboys v. away boys in Rock and Jock softball. Where was Dan Cortez, Corbin Burnson, Richie Sambora when you need them? You can't tell me that Roger McDowell and Spinderella weren't getting warm in the bullpen. And you can't tell me that they wouldn't have done better than the actual Dodger and Astro bullpens. Look, I don't know if the baseballs are juiced. Well, actually, I do. They are. More on that later. But I do know this. I know that if you take 2 great offenses and 2 bullpens full of arsonists, you're going to get some exciting baseball. Maybe arguably too exciting. I mean, that was like some kind of crazy, nonstop sugar rush or bender of baseball. Started out like you were funneling pixie sticks. But by the time you got to the 7th inning, it was like snorting powdered sugar and injecting cane sugar right into your veins. No lead mattered because nobody could hold a lead. Nobody could get anybody out. And it all started so well for LA, didn't it? It all started so well for the Dodgers. 3 runs in the first. You figure that you stake the best pitcher of a generation to a 3-run lead in Game 5 of the World Series, and you're going to be fine. And it only got better when they added a 4th. In the 4th, Keuchel's out of the game at that point. At that point, it felt like a ball game. You're not losing when you stake Clayton Kershaw to a 4-run lead in the most important game of his career. Ball game, thanks for coming. Except it wasn't. In fact, not even close. Because the Astros battle. They're relentless. And in the bottom of the 4th, they went to work. Carlos Correa had an RBI double. Then Yuri Gurriel came to the plate with 2 men on.
2 runners in scoring position. First pitch from Kershaw. And he lifts this one. Left field. Arriba! Gurriel! We're tied! Yuri Gurriel with a 3-run shot makes it 4-4.
Astros radio. Guy, don't you get the sense that anytime you get the ball in the air in that yard, it's got a better than average chance of going out? First pitch swinging. We've got ourselves a tie ball game. And the Astros had ripped out the hearts of the Dodgers. Except they hadn't, because the Dodgers also battle, and they grind as much as Houston. And in the top of the 5th, Cody Bellinger came up with 2 men on.
Pitch to Bellinger. Fly ball, right field. Reddick going back, way back, and it is gone! A 3-run home run for Cody Bellinger! Maybe 2 rows back in right. Bellinger with a big 3-run blast. The
Dodgers... Dodgers radio from 4-4 to 7-4. I mean, so impressive the way they battled back. And at that point, you've got to be thinking, it is their night. They're going back home 3-2. Ira's going to call. Matt in LA's going to call. Then again, if you were thinking that, you had not been paying attention to this series because we weren't even halfway through all the runs that were going to be scored. And sure enough, bottom of the 5th, 2 outs. George Springer works an 8-pitch walk. Alex Bregman worked a 10-pitch walk, and then Jose Altuve dug in.
Maeda set, 3-2 again. And Altuve hits this high in the air and pretty deep to center. Taylor is going back at the wall, looking up. See you later! See you later! A game tying 3-run home run for Jose Altuve. It's 7-7.
7-7 after 5. And yet somehow we managed to get through the sixth without either team scoring. The Dodgers take an 8-7 lead in the top of the seventh on a Bellinger hit to center that Springer dove for and missed. I get it. Great athlete. I love the effort. I love the heart. But if you're going to make that play, you better make that play. Then Dave Roberts turns to Brandon Morrow for the bottom of the seventh. It was Morrow's 12th appearance in 13 games. Clearly, it was one too many. It was too much to ask for because this guy had absolutely nothing. First pitch to Springer.
Here's the first pitch for Morrow.
And it's Springer! Atones for the ball in center! And crushes it to left field. We're tied again! A no-doubter over the train tracks. It's 8-8.
That was followed by a first pitch single by Bregman. And then on the second pitch of his at-bat, Altuve does this.
Morrow pitching for the third day in a row comes set. The pitch is hit hard to left field, sending the left fielder back, and it's over his head. Bregman's got a chance to score. He's racing. Here comes the throw to the plate. Not in time. Astros lead.
Uh-oh. Correa up next. He took a pitch for a ball, and then he took a ball for a ride.
Morrow's set. Here's the pitch. Correa pops it to left. It's pretty deep. Racing across Peterson onto the warning track.
It's gone! It's gone! Two-run homer by Carlos Correa. It's 11-8 Astros.
I love that call, too. This is what I mean. If you can get the ball in the air in that bandbox, it's got a shot. Did you hear the play-by-play, man? He pops it to left. Correa pops it to left. It's gone! I thought it was a pop-up to left. Either way, 11-8. And a brutal night for Morrow. 4 hits, 2 home runs, 4 runs on 6 pitches. Before the game, Dave Roberts had said that Morrow was unavailable to pitch. And now we know why. But Morrow pushed for it. The guy's a gamer. He wanted in. He wanted the ball. Total respect. But there was nothing there. And as much as you want to criticize this guy, nobody was a tougher critic of Brandon Morrow than Brandon Morrow. Quote, I was confident in my ability. End quote. He added, quote, it was probably selfish of me to make that call and try to push to get in. End of quote. This guy called himself selfish no less than 3 times when talking to the media. I mean, damn, ease up, B. But I get it. At that point, when he walked off the mound, that stadium was rocking. It really felt like the game was over. I thought it was over, but it wasn't. Because as bad as the formerly invincible Dodgers bullpen has been in this series, the Astros has been just as bad. It's like both pens are allergic to holding leads. And sure enough, Brad Peacock gives up a double to Jock Peterson. Then he hits Chris Taylor. Corey Seager doubles. Peterson scores, and then Taylor went to third. 11-9 Astros. And I'm still in the middle of the same take. Then Justin Turner hits one to right. However, the third base coach, did not send Taylor home to test Josh Reddick's arm. Or did he send him home?
Back, tag. Gotta go.
You're saying no?
I was saying gotta go, but I think he would have been out with that throw, honestly.
I thought you were saying no.
So Chris Taylor thought Chris Woodward was saying no. Woodward was sending him.
I mean, are you kidding me? That's an incredible exchange. That's an amazing exchange between the third base coach and the third base runner. Taylor misheard what he was trying to tell him. Go, 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 or no, no, no.
Back, tag. Gotta go.
You said no.
What's that?
You were saying no?
I was saying gotta go, but I think he would have been out with that throw.
Now that is brutal. That is brutal. So Taylor heard go and no and didn't leave. First off, I'm surprised that Taylor could hear anything in that dome. It sounds like an airplane is taking off every single time the ball is hit. But maybe you guys stay away from words like go and no that rhyme and mean the exact opposite. Maybe you go with run or stay from now on. That looked bad then, and then it looked even worse in the bottom of the eighth when Brian McCann put it out of reach with this.
1-0. And McCann drills this deep to right field. Puig is back at the wall. See you later! Brian McCann with a home run to put the Astros up 12-9. McCann's first home run of the postseason.
How stupid is this game? I'm on the same take. I'm still on the same take. 12-9 Astros. That was the ball game. Except, of course, it wasn't. Because in the top of the ninth, Yasiel Puig hooked a two-run shot over the fence in left with one hand. Now it's 12-11 Astros. Austin Barnes doubles, and then Taylor is at the plate again.
Pavinsky on 2-2 to Taylor. Base hit into center field. Barnes comes in to score, and the Dodgers have tied it at 12. This surreal game continues.
Taylor's unbelievable. This guy's so clutch. Tie game. And at that point, everybody watching had just about gassed out. Everybody watching, everybody playing, everybody managing. It was just too much. Complete and total insanity. On to extras. We went. Bottom of the 10th. Kenley Jansen gets the first two outs. Then he hits McCann, and then he walks Springer. Derek Fisher. Not that Derek Fisher. Comes into the game to run for McCann, and in steps Alex Bregman.
Bregman 1-for-4 tonight. First pitch. And Alex lines this in the left center field. That's a base hit. Fisher around third and coming home. Ethier up with the baseball. The throw to the plate. Not in time. Astros win. Astros win. Alex Bregman comes through with a walk-off RBI single. And the Astros win 13-12-10. They lead the World Series 3-2.
Ball game, finally. ABQ. FTW. Bregman is a killer. Absolutely brass. God, I love that guy too. An amazing player. 13-12 Astros, 3-2 Astros. Coming to Dodger Stadium tomorrow night. I can't wait. I just don't want this series to end in 6 or 7. I need 16 or 17 of these games. Mainline it into me. I mean, I don't know if it's really baseball. I don't know if it's really baseball, but I can't take my eyes off it. I don't know if it's really baseball, and it just doesn't matter. What an insane game. I'm exhausted after the take. Our guest is Greg Bishop. All right, so before we get into yesterday's game, let me get your thoughts on your sense of the Texas players or Texans players and their reaction to Bob McNair's comment that we can't have the inmates running the prison. If you had to guess, exactly what was their reaction when they first heard that, collectively?
You know, yesterday in the locker room, it seemed pretty clear afterward that they were pretty upset. And you could tell that because most of them were declining flat out to talk about it. There was one guy, Dwayne Brown, the left tackle, who basically said that they felt like McNair had said the wrong thing, that they were very upset by what he said, and that several of them had considered walking out of practice entirely on Friday, while only two ended up doing that. The rest of the guys, including DeAndre Hopkins, who had a great game yesterday, were just kind of trying not to address the situation. But Brown said a few times that he's sure it will continue to come up throughout the year.
Greg Bishop joining us, the senior writer for SI. So what about when McNair met with the players on Saturday in an attempt to explain what happened? What was their reaction then, and did that help at all?
No, I don't think it helped. In fact, I think it made it worse. And I think that they felt insulted by ultimately what he apologized for. You know, the first apology that he issued on Friday basically said he was sorry if he offended anyone. It was one of those non-apology apologies. And the second one, released on Saturday after the meeting, basically said he meant the NFL when he was talking about inmates, not the players. Had several players say to me yesterday, including the Seahawks receiver Doug Baldwin, that nobody believed that second apology and nobody really thought that he meant the league. So I don't think it went over well at all.
And then ultimately, the majority of players took a knee before the game. How significant was that response? And then how do you think that would have gone over if the game had been played in Houston as opposed to Seattle?
Yeah, you know, I think it was very significant. We haven't seen that many players kneel on the sideline. I would say I posted a picture of it on Twitter, and I had maybe 2,000 comments of people just arguing back and forth over whether these guys have the right to kneel and what it sort of meant. You know, I think that if it had been played in Texas, it would have been a totally different reaction. Yesterday, you heard some cheers after the anthem. You heard a few boos, I think, kind of mixed in there. But I don't think it would have played the same way in Texas, obviously. A much more conservative state there, and I believe the reaction would have been a lot more antagonistic than it was yesterday.
We're talking to Greg Bishop, and he touched on this, but What was the mood and the atmosphere like in that locker room after the game? In other words, are those McNair comments all in the past, or is this just not possible going forward?
It was really kind of interesting because there were so many things going on yesterday. Like, half the players were just talking about Deshaun Watson and how incredible he looked on the field in that game. You know, half of them were talking about how, they felt like they should have won and they shouldn't have given up the late score, you know, to ultimately end up losing. And then I think most of them were sort of just wary of, like, saying the wrong thing about McNair. It was clear that it was still bugging them. DeAndre Hopkins over and over kept saying Seattle played a good game when he was asked about McNair's comments. But that doesn't mean that they've forgotten it. They tried to move on and play football, and yet there's this sort of backdrop going on to everything. And I think that's sort of typical of this NFL season. It's been very political. There's been a lot of talk about these issues. And, you know, this was, I think, the entire season kind of wrapped into one afternoon yesterday.
Yeah, no doubt. That's what's amazing to me is it is so political and it's so politically sensitive. But at the same time, you get the best game of the year, and then you get Deshaun Watson. He was 19 of 30 for more than 400 yards, 4 touchdowns. He rushed for nearly 70 yards. How do you explain a performance like that from a rookie against a defense with that much talent?
I think it just speaks to the kind of year that Watson's having, and I think it also speaks to the way that NFL teams evaluate players. I mean, here's a guy who we watched in college play so well for so many years, a guy who beat Alabama in the national title game and almost did it twice, and yet we can talk ourselves into taking other guys in front of him or wondering if it's a reach to take him at number 12 or whatever. And I just think that Watson was a great quarterback coming into the NFL, but he's exceeded anyone's expectations. And, you know, he's got some good weapons outside. Obviously, Hopkins is one of the better receivers in the league. Will Fuller's taken a big step this year. You know, they have a decent line. And so, you know, to me, he's easily the offensive rookie of the year at this point. Russell Wilson even said yesterday they should just hand him the award right now.
You know, it's funny when you talk about it, it speaks to the way teams evaluate college players. But even the team that took him evaluated him a certain way. They had Tom Savage starting for week one. Did you ever think we'd be in late October and talking about Watson having the running games that he's having right now? Or more unbelievably, that Tom Savage actually started the season at quarterback with this guy behind him?
Well, that's a great point. I mean, how crazy is that? You know, here's a team that started Tom Savage at the beginning of the year. And now they're taking questions yesterday in the locker room about, like, is this the beginning of a rivalry between Russell Wilson and Deshaun Watson that will ultimately lead to a few Super Bowl face-offs? And that's in a matter of, like, 2 months. So I think that just speaks to how well Watson has played. I thought, he was pretty dazzling yesterday. I live in the Seattle area, so I've covered a lot of games at CenturyLink, and I haven't seen many guys carve up the Seahawks defense that way. They're always among the best defenses in the league. They had some pretty good plays yesterday, including a pick six from Earl Thomas. And yet, you know, it was big play after big play from the very first drive when he hit Fuller for that deep touchdown all the way to the end when he hit, Hopkins for the 72-yarder. So it was among the better performances I've ever seen by a quarterback at CenturyLink. And for a rookie who didn't start the beginning of the year, that's just crazy.
Greg Bishop joining us for a few more moments. But you make another very good point, though. What about Russell Wilson? Watson was so unbelievable that it's almost easy to forget what Russell Wilson did. 452 passing yards, 4 touchdowns, and 30 rushing yards. And the fact that Seattle actually won that game, what did you make of what you saw from Wilson yesterday?
Yeah, you know, I was like 1,500 words into my column yesterday, and I just started mentioning the Seahawks. It was like that kind of day. Like, they came back and won the game. Wilson sets a franchise record for passing yards. You know, I think with the Seahawks, it's always about, is their line going to be good enough to protect him and give him enough time so that he can make the kind of plays he's capable of making? And it just seems like every year they start off slower, the line is worse, and they start to get better and make a postseason push. So this feels kind of like that time. This was the best game Russell Wilson's played this season. He was protected pretty well. I don't think those two things are coincidental. And so, you know, this is a team, I think, in a very interesting year where it's pretty muddled in terms of contenders, that's very capable of making a run. And I think it would start essentially with Russell Wilson playing like he did on Sunday, although even that is hard to replicate.
Right, let me ask you this. He was protected pretty well, but he did lead the team in rushing still yet. So how concerning is that to Pete Carroll?
It's definitely concerning, and this is a team that's been their Achilles heel for the last few years. You know, they won the Super Bowl, 4 years ago, and ever since then, it's the line, and can they protect Russell Wilson? And so I think their season ultimately will come down to can the line protect him well enough to win a playoff game or two in January when it's cold and when there are great defenses opposite them. So to me, that remains their primary concern. I think it will, as long as, you know, the team is built the way that it's built right now.
Hey, Greg, one last question. You wrote a piece last week on Jared Goff and the two-phase plan that Rams GM Les Snead has. He had spent some time with Jim Collins, the author of books like Good to Great. He called that time that they spent together, quote, the best 6 hours of my life, before he thought of his family, and then he rephrased it as a top 10 moment. What did he take away from that time that applies to the Rams and to Goff, and why was that so valuable to him?
Yeah, I think it was mainly that he looks at, Collins looks at everything as situational. So there's this idea of what he calls it, the flywheel effect, of many different factors kind of working together. And I think that clicked for Les just in the way that it taught him that it's not just going to be Jared Goff that makes him successful as an NFL quarterback. It's so much of his success is dictated by the players around him. So they went out and got two offensive line starters and three receivers, including Cooper Kupp in the draft. It's getting the right head coach and a very young, offensive-minded Sean McVay. And it's letting McVay tailor the scheme around Goff's strengths to sort of protect and minimize his mistakes, let Todd Gurley do some running there. And when all those things are working together, they have sort of like their own flywheel. And so it reminded him of his conversation with Collins and the way they've kind of revamped the team together.
Great weekend in college football. Well, not for Florida. It was a crappy weekend for Florida, especially for Jim McElwain. He's out. The guy who rode into this season naked on a shark, allegedly, who had a 16-3 record in SEC play when the calendar turned October, didn't even finish the month. And after getting stomped by Georgia in the cocktail party on Saturday, 42-7, this guy's out of a gig 24 hours later. He beat Butch Jones to the breadline. As Florida AD Scott Strickland did not even wait for the contract buyout talks to be finished before he cut that cord. That's how bad this thing had gotten. That's how quickly this thing had turned. Pen to paper hasn't even happened, and his office already has a cleaning crew inside of it. I guess you could say there was blood in the water and that there was no chance that McElwain was going to wrestle back control of his gig. Not naked on a shark and not in his AD's office. Not after putting his foot in his mouth early, often, and repeatedly. And especially not after being brought in to fix an offense that in year three was still 113th best in the nation. Because Strickland did not hire McElwain, and he was not about to wait around to see if this guy could somehow turn the program around. Not when he sees the SEC East at a low point and Florida sinking along with it. Not when rival Georgia is ranked number two in the country and laying it on the Gators. And not when McElwain has had to live down moronic comments like the one he made at his introductory presser when he said, quote, I can win with my dog Clarabelle playing quarterback. Or how about that time he called out the administration's commitment to winning after beating Iowa in the Outback Bowl? And that's not Herb or Spurrier hoisting Crystal. That's Jimmy Mack out-dueling Kirk Ferentz for a bloomin' onion. And then McElwain really stepped in it last week when he stepped in front of the podium and he claimed Florida fans were making death threats to him and his family. But when he was asked about it by the administration, he offered no proof and really no explanation at all. Uh-oh! Look, this guy is a good enough coach, I suppose. Just not nearly as good as he thinks he is. But pretty good. Good enough. Good enough to get hired there. Good enough to get hired there and not make it through his third year. And on top of that, a coach that had 10 guys suspended for committing credit card fraud. A guy who's selling his own brand barbecue sauce at home games when he's only won 3 games this year. And a guy who came into Gainesville thinking he was Nick Saban, when maybe he had just been the guy who was making sure the Weather Channel was on and that the Little Debbies were stocked up in Nick's office. I guess what I'm saying is, life moves pretty fast in the SEC. And while everybody sat around waiting for Butch Jones to meet the Reaper, McElwain's the first guy to go. And after surviving an offseason, which included shark-humping allegations, he learned the hard way that wrestling great whites is one thing, being in fourth in the SEC East is another. Well, man, my man's got lots of time for lots of other pursuits, including deep-sea fishing. And Butch is still breathing. We are joined by Tigers quarterback Riley Ferguson. You've won four straight. You're coming off a game where the team put up 56 points. You won by 30. First things first, Riley, how is it to be a member of the Memphis Tigers right now?
Oh, it's just a blessing. I mean, there's a lot of good things happening here in Memphis, so it's just great to be on the team. You know, we're doing a lot of things just for ourselves and for the community, and I know the community has our back, so it's huge just for, you know, just Memphis as a whole for us to be out playing how we are right now.
And then not only playing, but winning, and winning the way you are. For instance, you've got a very balanced attack, which included nearly 300 passing yards and 300 rushing yards. But even despite that fact, after the game, wide receiver Anthony Miller said, quote, "That third quarter was terrible. We're back to the drawing board. We've just got to limit the mistakes. We've yet to play a complete game. That's our goal this season," end quote. So, Riley, what's that tell you about the attitude of the offense, that you win by 30 and guys are focused on the problems and not looking to do some kind of victory lap?
Yeah, I think that shows the maturity of our team. You know, we have a lot of the guys on this team who are great leaders, and you know, everybody wants to go out and be successful, and we know what we're capable of. We go out to practice every single day with each other, so you know, when it comes to the games, we want to go out and play four quarters worth of football, you know, a perfect game. But like Anthony said, you know, in the third quarter we kind of hit a lull and we had to go back to the sideline, get things corrected, and I think in the fourth quarter we came out and handled our business. But we're trying to go out and play a complete game every single week, and you know, trying to play as perfect as we can.
Memphis quarterback Riley Ferguson, my guest. You know, I want to talk to you about your journey and how you got to where you are right now, because to me it's remarkable and it's inspiring. One more thought about Anthony Miller, though. He's a guy who came to Memphis as a walk-on, and on Saturday he became the school leader in receiving yardage. He's got nearly 3,000 for his career. What's it like to play with him, and what's he mean to your team?
Unbelievable. You know, just everything he's done for this school, you know, coming in as a walk-on, the type of person he is, he's just an unbelievable human being, you know. Just being around him is just great on a daily basis. And, you know, he's one of the hardest workers I've ever been around. He has that dog in him, and I think that's what kind of separates him from everyone else, you know. And he's unbelievable, as you can see. You know, he goes out and makes a lot of big-time plays on Saturdays.
Riley, I know what you mean by that, but that's a great phrase. When you say he's got that dog in him, what do you mean?
He just plays – it's kind of a chip on your shoulder, I would say, and, you know, in another phrase. I think I would say he has a chip on his shoulder. He kind of goes out and, yeah, you can just tell he works a little bit harder than everybody else, and I think some of that comes from the chip on his shoulder, from how he had to, you know, work to where he just, you know, coming in as a walk-on and having to earn everything that's been given to him. So, you know, I tip my hat off to him, and I respect him a lot, and, you know, that's one of my good friends, so I want to see him be successful.
Well, I think you'd say the same thing about you when you look at your background. You had a monster career at Butler High School in North Carolina. You commit to Tennessee, but then you realize that's not the place for you. So then you go back home, and there was an expectation that you'd get some phone calls from other programs, yeah. But then that didn't happen, so you went to work. You got a couple of jobs. One was detailing cars. Another was working at a fence company. What were those jobs like?
They were definitely humbling. I can say that, you know, it was hard for me, you know, working a job like that, you know, knowing all the talent that I had. You know, I definitely didn't want to be at home in Charlotte, North Carolina, working a job. I definitely wanted to be in school playing football somewhere. But I think at the end of the day, you know, it shaped me into the man that I am today. And I think, you know, overall, it honestly helped me more than anything.
Riley, I mean, to be fair, these were not easy jobs, especially the job at the fence company.
Oh, yeah.
Let me explain this. Your boss at the fence company described your job of powder coating as, quote, an awful job. And the details are rough now. He said, quote, "You hang the gate in a paint booth. You spray the powder out of the gun. It's a dirty, dirty job. It gets everywhere. Then you take it and you have to roll it to one of the two ovens, which are set at 550 degrees. It's hot. It's terrible. But Riley was great. He was a hard worker, an awesome guy. I kept telling him he was an idiot to be working at a job like this." My question is, dude, that does not sound like a good job. A lot of guys in your situation would not have had a great attitude about a job like that. So how did you go about approaching that gig?
I think part of it is, you know, just growing up playing sports and playing football, and, you know, the way my parents raised me, no matter what I'm doing, I always want to go out and give my all and try and do whatever I'm doing to my best ability. And I think that's kind of, you know, the approach I took when it came to working those jobs. I knew that's not where I wanted to be. At the end of the day, that's where I was, and so I had to make the best of every opportunity I got, every single day that I got to live. And, you know, that's kind of how I approached every single day. And the people I worked with, everybody I was around, they were great, so I think that helped a lot with it as well.
Memphis quarterback Riley Ferguson, my guest. So you're finally at a point, and you described it this way, quote, "I sat at the warehouse by myself. I thought, this is unbelievable. I'm sitting here hungry. I have no money. I know I could be doing something else with my life," end quote. What do you remember about that very moment, and then how did things change from that point on?
Yeah, one thing I remember about it, I remember I was just sitting on a picnic table. I was outside of my job, and I was just thinking the main thing was, you know, not being able to eat. I think that was the main thing, you know. I definitely wanted to be in school playing football, but at the end of the day, I had to eat to stay alive, and I think that was one thing that, you know, kind of opened my eyes a little bit. I didn't even have enough money to go eat, so that just shows, you know, working that job, it wasn't the easiest thing, but like I said, I think it shaped me into who I am today, and it's just truly a blessing to be where I am, and I honestly take every day and try and live it as I can.
Tennessee fan, how you living? That question obviously is rhetorical because I already know the answer. Not very well. You know how I know that? Because your football complex still has a parking spot for one head coach, Butch Jones. That's how I know you're not living real well. Listen, I'm not here to rip any food off anybody's table. I'm not here to get anybody fired at all, ever. But how has this guy not been fired? How did Jim McElwain get it before he did? I mean, you can point to any number of fireable offenses, yet he's still gainfully employed. Good work if you can get it. What would you give to have a job? An incredible job. An extremely well-paying job. And no matter how bad you are at that job, they cannot fire you. It's pretty awesome. And that's Butch Jones. Quick recap for you. Butch Jones has never beaten Alabama. That's fine. A lot of people don't ever beat Alabama. Butch Jones is 1-4 against Florida. This year, he is winless in SEC play. And my man just got beaten by Kentucky. That's only the second time that's happened. Second since 85. So he can't beat Bama. He can't beat Florida. And he just now, come to find out, can't beat Kentucky in year 5. And to add a bag full of rock salt into the open wound on Rocky Top, Florida did go ahead and fire their guy in year 3, and they did it after back-to-back SEC East titles. How's that grab you, Knoxville? You can't even beat Florida when it comes to firing your head coach first. Then again, I think this is maybe where I'm missing something. Maybe I missed on how much weight did Butch's championship of life carries. A lot more than I thought. And now Vol fans are starting a hashtag Empty Neyland campaign. They've got the 5th largest stadium in the nation, and they want it to be completely empty until Butch is out of work. An embarrassing look to cap off one of the more embarrassing coaching stints in recent memory at any school. I mean, no joke. From claiming that he only recruits guys with, quote, 5-star hearts, to hoisting Rubbermaid trash cans on the sidelines during games. I mean, this dude literally is a buried game ball or a destroyed game tape away from hitting for the lame cycle. Derek Dooley once taught his Tennessee team the proper techniques of how to shower. And even that's not nearly as bad as some of the gimmicks that Butch has pulled out for Rocky Top. Or to quote Brad in Corona, he's a gimmicky little bitch. Tennessee has not won a natty since Bill Clinton was in office. They haven't even won their division. A weak one. In over a decade. And it's still Tennessee. I remember when the Vols were the Vols. I remember when Tennessee was Tennessee. I remember when they won a national championship. I remember we used to talk to Phil Fulmer on this show all the time. And it was a good time. But with each passing week, Tennessee only falls further and further and further into the gutter. Vol fan, if you don't like what I'm saying, and in fact, I know you do, otherwise you wouldn't have the hashtag you have right now. Vol fan, you agree with me. I know that already. But if you don't like it, if there's a few of you out there that don't like it, just be glad I'm saying anything at all about your program. Don't blame me. Don't blame Van Smack. Blame the Vol administration. I mean, here we are at Halloween. And Butch Jones really is a zombie. A true zombie. By any measure of the word. The dude's like completely lifeless. On the sidelines and off. But he absolutely will not die. You cannot kill this guy. I mean, props to Butch in that sense. He may not know how to win, but he certainly knows how to survive. And he outlasted McElwain, if you can believe that. He wasn't the first one to get gassed. Empty kneeling. That's quite a campaign. The fan base is trying to tell each other, whatever you do, don't show up. Do not go to the games. Do not go to the game. Cam Hayward is my guest. As a defense, you had three goal line stands, Cam, and did not allow a touchdown all game. How does it feel to go on the road in prime time and have the defense show up the way it did last night?
Yeah, you know, our backs were against the wall. You know, they moved the ball pretty good, especially with Stafford. He can throw all over the place. But I thought once the field got condensed, you know, we really tightened down and, you know, made some stands. You know, I think it came down to heart, hustle, just executing better.
And how about respect? As an example, linebacker Vince Williams said afterwards that when the Lions went for it on fourth down, quote, "I felt like they were trying us. It's disrespectful. Prater's a great kicker. You better run him out here or y'all are going about to leave without getting any points." So how much does it motivate the defense when somebody tries to test you guys on fourth down? And then what's it like when the group comes out of it the way that you guys did?
You know, I think the way we look at it is it's an opportunity for us to give them no points. You know, you better take that three or, you know, we're going to give a chance for our offense to go down and score. You know, I think it's just a big momentum shift because, you know, if you get four plays and you get stopped and it's multiple times, that's not going to give you a winning element.
Steelers defensive end Cam Hayward is my guest. You mentioned the offense. Ben Roethlisberger said after the game, "I love this defense. It's so much fun to watch." That was his quote. Now, you've been a part of some very good defenses there in Pittsburgh. What makes this group unique or different?
I don't know if anything stands out just yet. I think we're still learning a lot about ourselves. But, you know, I like to think that on any given play, I have 10 other guys out there that can make the play. And, you know, we have playmakers all around. And the crazy thing is this defense is still evolving. Guys are still getting better. You know, I think we can be even better team by the time December rolls around.
So what do you think? How good? I mean, I know you'll take it one week at a time. I know it's evolving. I know you're not there yet. But do you allow yourself to think about how good this team might be? I mean, could it be Super Bowl good?
You know, the way I look at it is we can be the reason why we win. You know we have a good offense. And if we hold teams to, you know, 0 or 3 points, you know, that's a win. And that's where we want to get to. And if you do that, you will win Super Bowls, but we know the job's not done.
You know, Cam, you mentioned the 10 other guys, so I know you're not going to make it about you, but your sack on Sunday moved you into a tie with Brett Keisel for third place all time for most sacks by a Steelers defensive lineman. Look, I know you've got a lot of football left in you, but when you think about the history and the tradition of the Steelers, what's it mean to you to know that your name is up there with some of the all-time greats?
You know, it's an honor to be a part of that group. Because I know the work they put in, and, you know, I'm just honored to be a part of it. But when it's all said and done, I want to be able to put my name at the top. I know that's a long way away, but I got to get to work.
Cam Hayward joining us. Okay, what about the offense? Juju Smith-Schuster had a 97-yard TD, a total of 193 yards on 7 receptions last night. What do you think when you see the young man go to work?
Man, I just think the sky's the limit with him. You know, for all everybody talks about, he's a, you know, a bigger wide receiver, and he's not going to be able to break away. Then he breaks off something like that. You're seeing this kid just grow up. The stage isn't too big for him. You know, you still got a guy like AB. So, you know, this offense is going to keep getting better, and he's going to keep getting better. And I'm just excited to see where this offense continues to grow.
You know, he's a young guy with a lot of energy. And even you said after the game, you appreciate the energy he brings. Us old farts don't know how to deal with it sometimes, but I'm glad we got him. Is there ever a time where you're tempted to say, hey, dial it down a little bit, youngster, or can you not do that with a guy like that?
No, I don't even think you need to, You know, because it's not anything that's disruptive. It's not anything that holds the team back. You know, it's just pure joy, and he's having fun with this game. I know it's a grown man's league, but, you know, when you got a kid who's young like that, that, you know, brings energy, you just want to keep him involved because, you know, it's going to rub off on other guys. And you saw that on Sunday.
It's infectious, for sure.
Yes, sir.
You're a captain on this team, so it's very clear the respect that your peers have for you. assistant head coach John Mitchell said, quote, he's been around football. He knows what it takes to be a good football player. He knows what hard work is. He isn't selfish. The thing I like about Cam since he's been here, he came with an attitude of whatever it takes, I'm going to be a good football player, end quote. I mean, now that you've been in the game a little bit, how much of success and being a great football player is about talent, and then how much of it is about mindset and the work that you put in?
I think it's more about the mindset. You know, I like to think when you get to the NFL, everybody's talented. It's about just finding that extra inch, that extra detail. You know, who executes better, who is able to work out harder, who runs to the ball, who's able to, you know, beat their guys. You know, this league comes down to the smallest details, and that's how you are able to show who's better and who's not. You know, there's so many good quarterbacks, but the ones that do the little things, and there's so many good defensive linemen, and the guys that do little things get them, you know, the touchdowns or the sacks. So, you know, I just try to take that week in and week out.
You know, and then there's so many good dudes. There's so many good dudes that do things off the field. And I think that he was talking not just about football, but the man that you are. And he talked about the 2015 Walter Payton Man of the Year Award that you won. Mitchell said, quote, when he got here, he saw some of the older players give back. The smart ones pick up on that. Cam is tireless. The money, the time he gives, you can't say enough good things about the guy. I love being around him, not because he's a good football player, but because he's a good person, end quote. That's really interesting to me. Like, for instance, who were some of the guys who inspired you when you got there when it came to being active in the community and giving back?
Yeah, you know, Brett Kiesel, I like to think he's a big mentor in my life, still is. Troy Polamalu, Aaron Smith. I got to see the way those guys, you know, gave back to the community, always put, you know, their energy into things they truly cared about. And, you know, I've just tried to, you know, do the same. You know, as I was a younger guy, you want to be a sponge, you want to pick up everything. And that was one thing I really took away. These guys, you know, dedicated not only their time to the football and to their families, but also to their communities. And, you know, it's so much more than football. And, you know, there's so many people we can affect. And, you know, I'm just glad I have this platform to do it.
Good for you. Hey, Cam, what about The Ohio State? What about your guys handling business the way they did in the fourth quarter to come back on Penn State? I know you had some other things on your mind this weekend, but how about the way they showed up and rallied?
Man, it was a heck of a game. You know, Penn State's a good team, but, you know, it just showed the grit of Ohio State. You know, those guys battled the entire game. Not everything went well for us, but I just love the way JT Barrett competed through the entire game. You couldn't be happier for a guy, you know, because he had dealt with a lot of heat on him, especially for that Oklahoma game, but, you know, the kid responded, and, you know, I'm very happy for him.
Cam Hayward, my guest. Cam, I'm not in that locker room, but I've got spies that are. I understand there's some legendary basketball games that go on inside your locker room. What do you guys use for a hoop, and who's the best player on the team?
We use a trash can. and I know you've got your spies out here. I see them sometimes. But, you know, I like to think I'm up there. Le'Veon is pretty good. But we got some feisty people out there. Rosie Nix, you got to watch out for. He'll try to get you in the predicament you're not used to.
Clones, that's Monday. Thank you very much for listening. Also, remember, check out Dana White tomorrow on the Jim Rome podcast, and we will be right back here tomorrow as well. See you then. I'm out.
I have finished about two bottles of Ron Chata with my crew at the Herrera Hideaway this weekend. Starting from Friday, Saturday, yesterday, you know, it's a tradition. Texans score, we take a shot. We took that on to the game, boss, and we were done.